sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm going to focus on Iraq, Iran, and of course, 9/11. First, I want to connect the dots between Iraq, Iran, 9/11, and the bigger picture or agenda. James P. Tucker Jr. says it well in an article in the American Free Press posted on December 9th, 2011, called Seven Nations on Neocon Hit List. And here's what he says in the article. Some 10 years before the September 11, 2001 attacks on New York and Washington, D.C., top neoconservatives in the Pentagon orchestrated a major policy coup to start wars with multiple Middle Eastern countries and secure total domination of the Middle East in order to take their oil. That's according to a top former U.S. military officer. In a speech in San Francisco, General Wesley Clark recounted a memo drafted by former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's office in the wake of 9/11 that was brought to his attention by a top Pentagon official. The neocons' plot, he was told, was to attack and destroy the governments in seven countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. Clark said the neocons wanted us to destabilize the Middle East, turn it upside down, make it under our control. While 9/11 provided an excuse for broadening the wars, neocons were plotting a decade earlier for regime changes across the Middle East. Clark cites a 1991 conversation with defense official Paul Wolfowitz, who said, "One thing we did learn from the Iraq War is that we can use our military in the region, in the Middle East, and the Soviets won't stop us. And we've got about 5 or 10 years to clean up those old Soviet regimes, Syria, Iran, Iraq, before the next great superpower comes on to challenge us." So as you can see, the attack and occupation of Iraq and the threats of an attack on Iran are part of a bigger plan. That plan has nothing to do with bringing freedom and democracy to these countries. And President Obama is continuing to implement this ugly agenda. It's now common knowledge that the U.S. attack and occupation of Iraq was based on lies. There were no weapons of mass destruction, no yellow cake, and no connection to terrorism. The lies were cooked up by the neocons in the Bush administration. Those lies have resulted in the deaths of 1.4 million innocent Iraqis and 4,500 U.S. soldiers, with thousands more injured both physically and psychologically. Just take a moment and contemplate all of this death and destruction, all based on lies, and all paid for by our tax dollars, done in our name. And I wonder why we're so complacent about this war. And if you think it's finally over, think again. As the soldiers come out of Iraq, the mercenaries, hired by the Pentagon, go in. And now I want to read from an article that was posted recently on globalresearch.ca, called Colonial Iraq, The Reality Behind the End of the Iraq War, and it was posted recently by Brian Becker. And here goes. "Our war there will be over. All of our troops will be out of Iraq," President Barack Obama said in his December weekly radio address. But while combat troops are leaving, for now at least, the U.S. government is creating a staff of 16,000 for its newly constructed embassy in the heart of Baghdad. Although Iraq has only 28 million people, the new U.S. embassy is the largest in the world. It's a massive compound that is 1.5 square miles, an enormous complex of 22 buildings and the size of 94 football fields. Half of the 16,000-person staff will consist of a private military army made up of mercenaries under the control of the State Department. The State Department budget for the embassy is estimated at $25 to $30 billion over the next 5 years. In addition, the Pentagon retains a vast network of bases, sea and air power surrounding Iraq. Washington's intention, clearly, is to dominate Iraq for many years to come in a colonial-style relationship. Iraq possesses the second largest oil reserves in the world. And now here's a recent short interview clip from Press TV that describes the situation in Iraq and the region.
President Obama has announced the United States will definitively end the war in Iraq at the end of this month. But as the United States attempts to get the military personnel and contractors out of the country, questions still remain about the implications of this decision for security in the region. Joining me to help discuss this is the former Indian ambassador to Iraq and the author of the book, The Ultimate Prize, Ranjit Singh Kala. Thanks so much for joining me. First of all, I want to ask you about the recent terrorist attacks in Iraq. Obviously, there have been quite a few in the past few years, and they've claimed hundreds of Iraqi citizens' lives. Do you think there's still a role for the United States in Iraq?
When the Americans walked in, they could not have done anything but to introduce some semblance of democracy. Otherwise, what was the reason of going in? And once they went in and they decided to introduce some semblance of democracy, it was going to be a Shiite-led government. And because it was a Shiite-led government, it has very strong links with its co-religious in Iran. And therefore, the main, aim, which I should say was to make sure that the oil, the vast oil wealth of Iraq, remains available, would be in jeopardy. And I think that is basically the present dilemma. If you withdraw from Iraq completely, you leave this vast oil wealth of Iraq in the hands of a Shiite-led government, which is very close links with Iran. And therefore, it upsets the political balance as far as the Middle East is concerned. So to that extent, to counter this, the Americans have now thought of withdrawing their troops, but at the same time, strengthening their position in Iraq. Now, the U.S. Embassy in Iraq is going to be about almost 20,000 strong. It's going to have numerous sub-offices, like training of troops, etc., who will be basically Americans, who would be basically military men, but working for the U.S. Embassy. Similarly, there will be a consulate in Basra, there will be a consulate in Kirkuk, there will be a consulate even further north. And each one of these consulates is about 1,000 strong. It will perhaps be the largest U.S. embassy anywhere in the world. I mean, normal embassies are usually between 30 to 40, maybe if it's a very big embassy, perhaps 100 strong. But 20,000 strong, it means that there are going to be lots of other people who are going to be still in Iraq. Now, the reason why I say this is that they cannot afford to be completely absent from Iraq. And therefore, while agreeing to withdraw troops as per the agreement, they are in a way coming back wearing civilian clothes. And in fact, I don't see any lessening of American influence as far as Iraq is concerned.
And you sort of just spoke about these sectarian issues within Iraq. When and if the United States technically leaves the country, how do you think the Iraqi government will be able to stop these sectarian divisions into becoming a full-fledged civil war?
It's going to be extremely difficult, because if you see the communities of Iraq as they existed, most of the military in pre-US invasion Iraq was Sunni dominated. Most of the officers were Sunni. The Shiites were basically foot soldiers. They had no basic military training as such. And therefore, because it was a Sunni-led government, they were able to keep them in check. It was basically by a force of arms that people were kept, in check. And of course, the strong arm methods of every ruler who has been there, whether it was Saddam or even earlier, most of them were using very tough methods to keep the population in check. Now, whether the new government, which is the Shiite-led government, will be able to equally take strong-arm measures to control the situation is a bit doubtful, because, frankly, I don't think they have the experience to be able to run a country like Iraq. And therefore, they're going to be, I foresee, sectarian violence perhaps may not be of the scale that it is now, but perhaps even little more than what is presently going on.
And you mentioned the United States troops going to Kuwait. How do you think the Arab Gulf countries are going to react to that? Are they going to welcome the Americans?
I don't think so, because I don't see this withdrawal taking place actually. I think it's just a reshuffle of the cards, so as to speak. Because the Americans are not going very far. They're just going to Kuwait, which is next door. And you can always come back, because the bases will be kept intact. And as I mentioned, with a 20,000 strong U.S. embassy, most of their staff, etc., will always be there. And secondly, they have made sure that there is no Iraqi air force. In fact, you find that there's hardly perhaps they don't even have 5 planes to fly around. So they don't control the airspace. The airspace over Iraq will be controlled by the Americans, which means that you can reinforce at will whenever you want, however you want. And you can also prevent anybody else from coming in, perhaps even if the Iranians were to decide. The American Air Force would be available to make sure that they don't cross over. So I don't consider this as an American withdrawal. I think it's just a reshuffling of the pack.
And what about Iran? Do you think Iran could potentially be ready to fill some sort of void if the United States leaves Iraq?
Well, that is always a possibility, because the Iran-Iraq border is very porous. It's very difficult to police the entire border. It's a very long border. And in many areas, you find, of course, there are mountains, then there are the plains, and there is a river, the Shatt al-Arab, which is the boundary between Iran and Iraq. And then most of the tribesmen living on the Iranian side are also Arabs, and they are Shiites too. So there is a lot of to and froing going across the border, and there is intermarriage, and there is also a lot of, should I say, illicit trade which goes on across the border. So as far as the Iranians wanting to intervene or to create problems in Iraq, that is always a possibility. And don't forget, in the past, it was the Iranians who used to provide arms to the Kurds to create problems for Saddam Hussein. And so it won't be the first time, and probably not the last time either, when they would do so.
Obviously, you know, President Obama also has announced that he's going to pull the troops out of Afghanistan. We're about to enter an election year. How much of pulling out troops from Iraq and Afghanistan do you think is part of for domestic consumption by the Americans?
Well, obviously, he has to meet deadlines which have been set by himself. I mean, the U.S. administration have set the deadlines themselves. And as I mentioned, in the case of Iraq, it's basically a reshuffling of the pack. I mean, you give it another name, you change it around, call them what you like. But as far as Afghanistan is concerned, perhaps a similar kind of strategy may be followed, where you may be able to withdraw, U.S. may be able to withdraw troops from Afghanistan, but leave a very strong component behind, perhaps in the form of civilian advisors, military advisors, and training teams, etc., who may not be taking part in combat role, but they can certainly act as an advisory role to the new Afghan army as and when it develops. But in any case, I think that's a little far away. So let's see, because I don't think it's going to be a decision which is going to be taken so quickly.
And the United States has spent so much money in Iraq, $3 trillion. What do you think the Americans can gain from everything that happened there?
I've always believed that anybody who's lived in Iraq, as I have lived in Iraq, that nobody goes there for tourism. It's a country which is hot. It's 50 degrees centigrade most of the time. There are flies, there are pests, there's everything here. There's nothing to see except plain desert. What are you there for? You're there for the oil, obviously. Otherwise, why would anybody spend $1 trillion to go there, lose about 4,000 to 5,000 casualties, 50,000 injured? What for? And the reason is the oil in Iraq is plentiful. And secondly, it's of a very high quality, very high grade. You don't need to refine very much to it. The sulfur content is very low. And thirdly, it's just below the surface. It costs $1 to take it out, $1.50 to take this oil out. And therefore, anybody who has access to this oil can be a game changer as far as the politics of oil is concerned. And I think that's precisely the reason why the Americans are there.
There's a little light of hope coming out of Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, that restores my faith in humanity. They held a war crimes tribunal. The case being tried was entitled Chief Prosecutor of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission versus George W. Bush and Anthony L. Blair. And these are the unanimous views and findings that they wrote up. The two accused, George W. Bush and Anthony L. Blair, At the material times, the heads of the governments of the United States of America and the United Kingdom, respectively, have been charged by the chief prosecutor of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission with having committed crimes against peace, in that they have planned, prepared, and invaded the sovereign state of Iraq on 19 March 2003 in violation of the United Nations Charter and international law. The particulars of the charge state, inter alia, that on 19 March 2003, the two accused launched a war against Iraq without the sanction of the United Nations and without just cause whatsoever. The two accused were not present at the proceedings, though duly served, nor were any attorneys or counsel present in their behalf. Pursuant to Article 15 of the Charter of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission and the Rules of Procedure and Evidence of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, an amicus curiae was appointed by the tribunal to assist the tribunal by presenting an unbiased assessment of the charge and evidence against the accused. A plea of not guilty was entered on behalf of both the accused. 9/11 is also brought up in these criminal proceedings, and in the document it states, the defense cites authority contending that September 11 attacks on the United States demonstrate a change in the nature of the threats confronting the international community, thereby paving the way for rapid development of new rules of customary international law that would presumably authorize the invasion of Iraq. Yet, it is still unsettled what the events of September 11, 2001 are all about. So clearly, the criminal court here doesn't buy the official story of 9/11 either. This is a 10-page document, and this is what it says under the verdict section. The 2003 invasion of Iraq was an unlawful act of aggression and an international crime. It cannot be justified under any reasonable interpretation of international law. It violates the outer limits of laws regulating the use of force. It amounts to mass murder. Unlawful use of force in Iraq threatens to return us to a world in which the law of the jungle prevails over the rule of law, with potentially disastrous consequences for the human rights not only of the Iraqis, but of people throughout the region and the world. The report goes on to recommend that the commission file reports with the International Criminal Court against Bush and Blair, and it also recommends that the commission name the two convicted criminals, Bush and Blair, to be included in the Commission's Register of War Criminals and publicized accordingly. If you want to read this document for yourself, you can Google Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission and George Bush, and I think you'll find it. And now that we've destabilized Iraq, killed over 1 million innocent Iraqi citizens, spent trillions of our dollars on the war, and had the criminal court in Malaysia hold a tribunal that found Bush and Blair guilty of mass murder, it looks like the Obama administration and Israel are pushing ahead with their agenda to invade yet another of these seven countries on their hit list, this time Iran. And now here's another clip from Press TV about the situation with Iran.
Tehran continues to mull over a proposal from the International Atomic Energy Agency, which would see its uranium sent abroad to be enriched. The aim is to provide fuel for its reactors, but to prevent it being used for weapons. The ultimate nightmare pessimist straw is the world's worst weapon in the hands of a revolutionary religious regime. To discuss whether those concerns are justified, I'm now joined by German publicist and geopolitical expert Jürgen Elsässer, who has recently published a book, Iran, Facts Against Western Propaganda. Hello, Jürgen. Thanks for joining. So the U.S. together with Israel are planning an attack on Iran. That's at least according to your book. What proof of that do you have?
One proof is that Turkey did not want Israel to take part of a common military exercise in October. So Turkey fears, Premier Erdogan fears, that Israel could use the territory of Turkey for an attack against Iran. In the U.S. Congress in October 2009, $800 million were pushed into a program to develop super bunker-busting bomb. And this money from the Congress was proposed and was granted after a request of the U.S. Central Command. which is responsible for the whole Middle East and also for Iran. And Central Command argued that they need this bunker-busting bomb for an imminent attack against sheltered bunkers in a highly risky environment. That is kind of describing the Iranian situation.
And what are the central lies you claim to be exposing in your book?
They say Iran is trying to build an atomic bomb and to use it against Israel. But this is only propaganda. There is no proof for it. And it's just a remake of the lies against Iraq, which the U.S. presented in 2002 and 2003. And it is very surprising and shocking that world opinion is believing into the same lies as against Iraq, now against Iran. The U.S. don't even try to prove it, because they know there is no proof, because the Atomic Energy, the International Atomic Energy Agency, has a complete control over the Iranian nuclear program, and there is nothing to be proven.
And what will the war plan be? Will it be similar to that in Iraq in 2003?
There are for sure certain detailed plans, but that is not the cause to be worried, because such plans existed all the times, and every superpower has to write down such plans. But the problem is that you have in Israel a highly extremist government who could provoke a war even without the consent of the American president. In fact, at this moment now, the American president, Barack Obama, is not the key of the situation.
Well, since you mentioned Obama, one of the chapters in your book is called Obama Ya-Nein Yain. How would you explain this Yain or yes-no in the U.S. policy?
If you see the Obama position, he gave several famous speeches about the Middle East situation. And there are two famous speeches in which he is very moderate. For example, his speech in March 2009 for the Iranian New Year, where he said, we need a new chapter in our relations, we need relations based on mutual respect, we don't want to go on with threats anymore. That was okay, that was moderate. You have the speech in June 2009 at the Cairo University about the relationships between the US and the Islamic world, where he said, okay, we have to find a solution for the nuclear energy question in Iran, but we should do it not by threats and by war. But at the same time, you have a third speech, and nobody talks about it in the Western media, during his election campaign. He spoke in summer 2008 in front of the biggest organization of the Israel lobby in the States, the AIPC. And in this speech, he said, we must support Israel with the most elaborated weapons, and Israel has the right to defend its sovereignty even far outside its borders. Iran is the biggest threat for Israeli security and so on. So very tough speech. And at the moment, we don't know which is the real Obama. Is it the moderate one, or is it the Falcon?
In your book, you say that the German press feels intimidated by the Western anti-Iran propaganda campaign and therefore cannot report real facts on Iran. Why would press in a free democratic country like Germany feel intimidated?
I guess we are under big pressure of the United States. And you see, one of our big media trusts, Springer, which publishes a lot of papers in millions and millions, circulation, everybody who wants to work there has to sign a declaration not to write anything against Israel and the United States. So there's a big pressure. That is not a free press.
And what role could and should Russia play in coordinating Iran's nuclear policy?
Russia can be a good broker, and in fact is already a good broker. We have this compromise from September, October, where the Iranians agreed to give away their lowly enriched uranium to Russia so that Russia can enrich it to a level of about 20% and then bring it to France, and they finish the process of producing nuclear fuel and give then the product back to Iran. That is a good proposal that shows that Iran is ready to agree to compromises, and that is a proof that Iran trusts Russia, and Russia can be the key, a real broker between the mistrust in the West, the mistrust in Israel on one side, and the ambitions of Iran to continue its peaceful nuclear program.
So the bottom line is that Iran should stay firm on its nuclear rights, including the right to enrich uranium.
Iran should not give in, because developing nuclear energy is the right of every nation state on this planet. And Iran has agreed to the non-proliferation treaty and is following all the rules which come out of this treaty. So there is no reason for Iran to give in, and I think it would even be bad if Iran would give in and bow to the pressure of the Western superpowers.
And how would you feel, say, in a couple of years, if Iran really comes up with a bomb? Do you accept you could be proved wrong?
My book and my opinion is based on facts. The facts tell me that at the moment and in the next 5 to 8 years, Iran is not technically in the situation to build an atomic weapon. What happens afterwards, nobody can know. But the main thing is, politics have to be based on the reality, not on speculation. If you base your decisions on speculations, you end up like the Bush administration, who made a terrible war against Iraq based on fiction.
Thank you very much for that snapshot. Jürgen Elsässer, German publicist and geopolitical expert, on his latest book, Iran: Facts Against Western Propaganda.
And again, that was a recent Press TV interview. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. 9/11 Wake Up Call airs on WWUH 91.3 FM on Wednesdays at 12 noon and on WESU 88.1 FM on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. To hear earlier shows, the more recent ones can be accessed at radioforall.net. And that's the digit for radioforall.net. And my earlier shows can be found at the very informative website, ct911truth.org. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.